thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub Online podcast. This unedited audio was taken from The Cane Only Works If You Use It by Cass Peters. It was first broadcast live on Thursday the 22nd of May 2025. A video of this and many other recordings can be found at sitp.online. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you'd like to support what we do, you can subscribe to our Patreon, Skeptics in the Pub Online.
All right, hello. Hi, everybody. I'm Cass. I wanted to start out with a little bit about myself, since my qualifications might be a little more wibbly-wobbly than some of the speakers you see on here. I am an almost doctor, which means that I did my PhD in sociology at the City University of New York, and I was nearly finished when I had to step down because of health issues. In the course of that program, I did finish a graduate certificate in disability studies. I then went on to teach sociology and criminology at the State University of New York, and I supplemented my meager adjunct income by doing freelance research, mostly working with qualitative interview data. Some of my work was even read on the floor of the U.S. Senate, for whatever that's worth, but in classic senatorial style, they completely ignored our findings and went ahead with the politically expedient conclusion. It was around this time that I started working for disability organizations, and I ended up traveling the country giving talks to organizations about disability inclusion, with a particular emphasis on service dogs. Now, unfortunately for you, all of this happened pre-transition, so you don't get any embarrassing early 2000s photos of me. So, in penance, here is a photo of my service dog who was with me through my entire academic career. This is Paxel, and she's here with me in a butterfly garden. You can tell how chill she was by the fact that the butterfly landed on her, and we had to physically remove him before they would let us leave. Now, this isn't just pet tax, and not just because service dogs aren't pets, but an important piece of context. So I walked around with this beautiful dog with a coat labeling her as a service dog and me as her disabled handler, and yet I spent years of my life going through unnecessary pain because I refused to add a cane to my repertoire because I thought I was too young. And this is super common, and it's a real problem. So research tells us that non-use and underuse of needed devices can cause pain, excess disability, plus additional personal and societal costs, such as the inefficient use of medical resources. So to take one example, a hemiplegic gait, which is characterized by stiffness on one side, it's caused by stroke or other conditions that cause significant muscle weakness. So this form of impaired gait uses more energy than a standard human gait, regardless of speed. So to walk the same distance, people with a hemiplegic gait consume 37 to 67% more energy than those without impairments. Also, impaired mobility slows gait, which compounds the effect over time, right? The longer you take the walk, the more energy it takes, and so on. So people with impaired gait also adjust and compensate, which can lead to potential future injuries. But when researchers looked at cane use in stroke victims, they found that patients walking with a cane demonstrated more normal spatial variables and joint motions than those without a cane, and thereby they consumed less energy and potentially shielded themselves from future injuries. Underuse is also associated with lower life satisfaction, though, of course, we don't know the causal direction for this relationship, right? So it could be that higher life satisfaction, those with more higher life satisfaction were buffeted against the causes of underuse, or it could be that the benefits of assistive tech use, such as lower pain levels, improve life satisfaction. And the scope of underuse can vary dramatically, depending on what aid we're talking about, plus the demographics of the users. So going back to service dogs for a moment, one Norwegian study of blind users found that those with access to a guide dog, only 4% of them said that they underutilized it, compared to 81% of those who had access to white canes. And it actually takes a little longer to train with a cane than it does with a dog, so this isn't just a function of how much effort they've put in. This study is particularly interesting because they were able to control for access to training and other support, and the overall rate of underuse was only 14%, which is shockingly low compared to some other studies. And here's where I spend an hour saying it's complicated, because some studies show an underuse rate of up to 70%. So why is there such a big spread? Well, some of it's down to demographics. For example, if you live in a country that doesn't provide good quality healthcare and free access to AIDS, you're going to have a harder time accessing them. We also know there's other variations in cultural rejection, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. So, for example, we know that doctors are more likely to take pain seriously when it's presented by white men compared to all other groups. Some of the variation is certainly going to be down to methodological artifacts. So, for example, who gets to define what underuse means? Is it the end user? Is it the healthcare provider? Is it someone else? Sometimes it's even hard to agree on what need means. So, minority adults, for example, are much more likely than their white counterparts to not assign a mobility impairment to themselves regardless of their results on physical performance tests. So, strictly speaking, they as They are as impaired as their white counterparts, but they don't acknowledge those issues as an impairment. Also, a lot of our studies are quite small and deal with only one specific population, so it's quite hard to gain an overall picture. You'll probably be unsurprised to hear that a lot of the studies come from the field of gerontology and thus deal exclusively with older populations. But we're going to try our best here. So the giant caveat that more research is needed, but very quickly first, what is assistive tech? So assistive tech is any device that enables a disabled person to do things they might not otherwise be able to do. A lot of people's minds immediately go to mobility aids. So we've got canes and crutches, rollators, walkers, various types of chairs. But assistive tech is much more than that. It encompasses, for example, changes to people's environments like shower seats and grab bars for mobility impairments, visual smoke alarms and doorbells for folks with hearing impairments. It can be custom made like this cutlery set, or it can be a repurposed piece of assistive tech like voice activated appliances. It can be as expensive as a complicated hoist system or as cheap as a fidget toy. So a couple of years ago, there was an excellent meta-analysis done at Swansea University, and they identified 6 primary themes of barriers to access and utilization of assistive tech: design and function, awareness and information, service provision, psychological support network, and societal barriers. Now, don't worry if you can't read that diagram, because we will be going through them one by one. Now, this is quite a restrictive analysis. They started out with over 7,000 papers at the keyword stage, and only about 40 made it through the selection. So this isn't the final word on assistive tech. But what is significant is that they were able to identify these themes across a variety of diagnoses. So these barriers exist regardless of the specific medical needs of the respondent. So I'm going to be using this paper as a framing device and bringing in information from other studies, as well as some of my personal experience, to flesh out some of these themes. Obviously, there's a lot of interconnectivity between these themes. We'll talk about that as we go on, as well as how these themes can impact different groups in different ways. So our first theme is design and function, and here is where we look at the assistive tech itself. Will the end user be able to set it up on their own, or will they need assistance? Can they do their own maintenance? A well-designed aid should be able to be set up and maintained by the user, and if that's not possible, it should be tied to a service that's easy for that user and their care team to access. How much does it cost? Obviously, this is going to be interconnected with service provisions and societal issues. Consider, for example, a wheelchair user in America versus a country with nationalized healthcare. A user who lacks those services may need to purchase their tech secondhand, and it might not be properly fitted to their body. As much of an advocate as I am for the use of assistive tech, it is not true that any aid is better than no aid. You can seriously injure yourself by using an aid that's not properly sized to you or that is of dubious quality. Poorly fitting chairs, for example, can cause strain on joints as well as pressure sores, which are nasty things and require expensive and costly rehab. According to NHS England, the cost of treating pressure sores can be up into the tens of thousands, depending on their severity, as well as resulting in the loss of the independence for the person while they recover. A one-size-fits-all strategy is not going to serve a population with individualized needs, and if an aid is causing pain, it's likely to be discarded. One study found that 24% of NHS wheelchair service users bought a second chair out of pocket because the chair provided by the service was causing them pain. Now, obviously, that's a privilege not everyone has. Is the tech reliable and sturdy? Even in situations where service provision is available, we see a difference between white and minority disabled populations. Minority users often report mistrust of services and suspicion that the aids that they receive may be substandard, for quite understandable reasons, right? There is a long history of medical racism that influences these fears. And indeed, there is evidence that African Americans have a harder time accessing tech and services, particularly for pain and fatigue-related conditions when compared to their white counterparts. Moving on to aesthetics. Clinical aids are ugly, and they can send the message that disabled people aren't interested in or worthy of beauty. These aids can reduce users to their medical needs and depersonalize them, and they can even be a trigger for users with medical trauma. So if your wheelchair looks like you belong in a hospital, it can really be hard to feel like you're out there living an independent life. And that's not even getting into how clunky the steering on those things is. Users across a wide range of studies repeatedly complained about the looks of assistive tech. Now, this might look like the older ladies with progressive mobility issues who were suddenly much more interested in the walker when they learned it came in pink, or the kid who refused a communication device because it came in the color of his football team's rivals. Both of those are real examples from the literature. Fortunately, there are disabled makers out there that are making pretty aids, but this stuff is not cheap. So we'll talk a little bit more about costs later. But just for a quick comparison, this pair of ugly, boring crutches is free on the NHS, whereas this sparkly crutch is £159 for each one. So aesthetics is not going to be something that's evenly distributed across the population, even within a given country. In one study of visually impaired users, smart glasses were much more readily taken up than other potential aids. They were described as cool and futuristic. Significantly, aids with a neutral appearance were discussed by users without even using the term disability. These were things that anyone might use. And even though things like glasses are technically assistive tech, they were common enough to be just a part of life and were thus less stigmatized by users. We'll talk a little bit more later about the connotations of disability and how that can impact usage. Does it fit into the user's life? If you live in a rural area without paved roads, are you going to be able to use a power chair? If you rent your home, can you install grab bars, or is that going to void your security deposit? Tech is much more likely to be taken up if it fits in with solutions that are already in place, and it isn't an obstruction to well-ingrained patterns. So, for example, folks who use mobility aids are going to have a lot of trouble with tech that requires the use of their hands. So, an adaptive key turner like this one here is going to be great for somebody with tremors or reduced hand function, but somebody who needs both hands on their walker might do better with a proximity lock. And that, of course, is a more expensive option, and not everyone has that privilege. And frankly, you're going to hear me say that a lot during the talk, so feel free to take a shot every time I do. I think that's three so far. Moving swiftly on, our second theme revolves around information. Who has it? Who needs it? And the extremes of not enough and too much. So we're already starting to see the interconnectedness, right? In order to safely use and maintain assistive tech, end users and their families need training, but many report not receiving it. One study of NHS wheelchair service users found that a full 33% of them received no training at all in the aid's use. There's also a lack of information about what tools are available to users and where they might come from. Older users in particular might not be aware of what smart devices are capable of. Blind users might not be aware of the AI tools that are available to them now. It might be an issue of not knowing that an individual is eligible for a given tool through local services. And going back to aesthetics, in multiple studies, users reported not realizing that aids were available in more than institutional gray. That information changed their willingness to take on the tech. On the flip side, several studies showed respondents complaining of information overload, where users are given too much information and they can struggle to retain any of it at all. This is particularly of concern for those with memory issues and brain fog, or for older carers and end users who lack a certain level of media literacy. There can be difficulty with discernment. Many users struggle to differentiate trustworthy information from woo. So a great example of this is the difference between assisted communication, which is a real collection of tools to help communicate, and facilitated communication, which is a discredited pseudoscience no more accurate than a Ouija board. An exhausted carer, overwhelmed and overloaded, can be easily misled and waste their energy pursuing the wrong one, or worse, they could avoid a useful tool because they've lumped it in with the woo. Similarly, healthcare providers report a lack of information on assistive tech. Now, obviously, not every practitioner can be an expert on every subject, and GP schedules are stretched quite thin, and this is becoming more and more of an issue as that becomes more true. Doctors can also have concerns about the quality of evidence behind a given piece of tech with varying levels of reasonableness. A decade or so back, I was working on a pilot project, and one of our participants was unable to get GP sign-off unless we provided him with large-scale research backing the intervention. When we tried to explain to the doctor that large-scale research definitionally happens after pilot research, he still refused to let her participate. But even with more common assistive aids, doctors report feeling uneasy about recommending best practice for tech use and that they lack up-to-date information on the tools that are available. Doctors might not necessarily have the expertise, for example, to help a patient through the vast array of options available to them. Here are all the options for electric wheelchairs made by a single manufacturer. According to the BMJ, the average length of a GP appointment is under 10 minutes. Nowhere near the time that a doctor is going to need to advise a patient on the tools that are available to them. If the patient has access to a specialist, that might improve their chances, but not everyone has that. And this can be a real problem because across a wide variety of studies, we see that a doctor's advice is one of the most likely things to be associated with uptake of assistive tech. But doctors are not the experts that patients think they are, at least not always. And they're just as susceptible to these issues as their patients. Doctors and patients both complain about a lack of information on services. So to give an example, when I first became disabled, there was a department called Adult Social Services, which I was eligible for. They came to my house, they installed things like railings and grab bars and a shower seat. It was great. Years later, the foam on the shower seat had degraded to the point that I had to sit at an awkward angle and it was causing me pain. So my GP, who is amazing and no, you can't have her, agreed to send me back to them for a repair. But there was a problem. Adult Social Services no longer existed. The department had been broken up and bits of it had been integrated into other departments and shuffled around, and no one knew who was responsible for repairing something that had been installed by a department that didn't exist. And because it wasn't a new install, I didn't fit into any of the qualifying boxes for any of the services that we were able to find. Now, presumably, a pathway to repair existed somewhere, but between an overworked doctor and a patient who was still bedridden half the time, there just wasn't the capability to hunt that information down. And in the end, I paid out of pocket for a new shower seat to be installed, which is, of course, a privilege that a lot of folks don't have. This brings us to our next theme, which is service provision. Unsurprisingly, a common complaint from users and care teams is a lack of follow-up support. Now, this can be as simple as checking in to see if the user is making the most of their equipment. Is it still working for them? There's an issue of maintenance. Multiple respondents had broken equipment sitting in their homes with no one to repair it, and others lived in constant worry that their gear would break and they'd be eventually stuck without assistive tech, whether they wanted it or not. Another issue we see is confusion surrounding how one goes about actually acquiring the tech. The process itself can be likened to the information overload that we saw earlier. For example, a wheelchair user here in the UK might have the frame of their chair covered by their local wheelchair service, but their wheels are supplied by Access to Work, and their power assist is expected to come from funds out of their personal independent payment. Now, navigating that system can sometimes feel like a full-time job in and of itself, and that's after you've navigated the application process for all of those services. And even if you do manage to navigate the system, there is still the time consideration. On the NHS, successful applicants to the wheelchair service can have very long waits. So 30% of them wait more than 6 months, and 15% wait more than 2 years. And that is only, remember, successful applicants. If an intervention isn't timely, the aid may no longer be relevant by the time it arrives. Sometimes that can be for a positive reason. Obviously, the condition has improved, but more frequently it's the opposite. So by the time someone receives a manual chair, they might need a power chair. 50% of NHS wheelchair service users were forced to buy a second chair because their needs had changed and the service had not provided for that. Because mobility aids are specialist supplies with very few manufacturers, it's often the case that users don't have the ability to trial their aids before they receive them. So this can lead to people receiving aids that don't work for them, which will sit unused, or perhaps they'll avoid buying them altogether. So right now I'm in the process of looking into power assists for my chair, and I've narrowed it down to two options. One of them is $5,000, and it provides an in-home demonstration. The other is $1,500, but there's no chance to try before you buy. So do I roll the dice and hope for a good outcome, or do I spend the extra for peace of mind? And that's a big chunk of change, given that 30% of disabled folks live in poverty, only about 50% are in work, and of those that do work, there's about a 15% pay gap between them and the non-disabled community. So a lot of disabled folks don't even have the option of making that choice. Sometimes trial options aren't available because aids are made in such small quantities or because they might be custom made to the individual, right? There's no way to try out a prosthetic without buying it because it has to be molded to your body. But that ties into another issue that's highlighted in the meta-analysis, is that aids can sometimes be unsuitable if they're built with a one-size-fits-all mindset. So you honestly end up with issues either way. It's quite a complex situation. One thing that's repeatedly highlighted by respondents is that services are based on diagnosis rather than on symptoms. So that might mean that an individual can't access a tool which would be very useful to them because it isn't strictly within the remit of the service that they're under. So for folks with a spinal cord injury, the pathway to getting a wheelchair is often pretty smooth. but for someone with an energy-limiting condition, they might have a significantly harder time. And that's also an issue because people can wait years for a diagnosis. A 2016 study found that 45% of patients with ME waited over 2 years for a diagnosis, and that is potentially 2 years with no access to services. All of this is tied up in the medical model of disability, which defines disability purely in medical terms with a particular focus on compartmentalizing people's health and seeing their disability as springing exclusively from their impairment. The focus is on fixing the person's body and seeing disability and disease as something separate from the person that must be cured or removed. So focus is put on aids that get people out of the hospital rather than on providing long-term independence. Doctors will focus on trying to get their patient up out of their chair rather than get them a chair that's better suited to their needs. The expectation here is that walking is not only the default, but the ultimate end goal of all users. In contrast to the medical model stands the social model, which sees disability not as an inherent characteristic of an individual, but as an interaction between the individual and the society in which they live. What disables someone in a chair is not their diagnosis, but rather the lack of curb cuts and ramps. Blind and deaf people are disabled by the lack of communication tools in their society, not by their sensory impairment. The social model is well summed up by this protest sign from the march which preceded the 1990 Capitol crawl. It's a fascinating piece of history, anybody looking, if you've got a want a new rabbit hole to fall down into. You have probably noticed me using the term non-disabled, where years ago I might have used the term able-bodied. And that's a reflection in a shift of language, which is informed at least in part by the social model. First, of course, not every disability impacts the body, right? Someone with mental illness is still disabled, even if their body doesn't need any accommodations. But second, it implies that some bodies are more able than others, or that ableness is a static feature rather than something that can change on a day-to-day basis. I am perfectly able to get my body around, unless there's stairs in the way, in which case my independence suddenly becomes disabled. Using the social model can help us understand why it's so hard for some people to label themselves as disabled. Taking on that label acknowledges our position as an oppressed minority that is subject to larger social forces, which can be really difficult for some folks. But I would argue that taking on the label and visibly marking yourself as disabled through the use of needed assistive tech can be incredibly empowering. But there are certain barriers to overcome this. So let's talk about those. Moving on to our next theme, we have our psychological barriers with two main sub-themes: individuals' attitudes toward their condition and their attitudes toward the tech itself. And those of you who came to my Skepticamp talk will know what's coming next. We need to talk about internalized ableism. Now, this is going to get a little bit heavy, so let's all take a breath and just enjoy the pet tax. Everybody good? All right. Ableism is, of course, the social prejudice and discrimination against the disabled, and it can be difficult for non-disabled folks to see any path to acknowledging the possibility of a good disabled life. And this isn't surprising, given the stories that we're often told about disability. So if you look at disabled characters in fiction, more often than not, they're villains made bitter and angry by their disability. Or they're a sympathetic character whose story arc ends in their cure, right? That's straight out of the medical model. And we internalize these stories as members of the culture. Any form of prejudice can be internalized because we are all products of the society that raised us. So a classic example of internalized racism comes to us from Clark's classic study of children's doll preferences, where African-American children can be seen holding strong preferences for white dolls over black ones, identifying the black dolls as bad and the white ones as good, even when asked to identify which doll looked more like them. More recent revisits of this study have found the effect reduced, but still very much alive in the current generation. Now, internalized oppression is insidious because humans are social creatures and we are natural storytellers. In the case of internalized ableism, we see respondents describing hypothetical users of assistive tech as not normal, that something is wrong with them, that tech use signals a deficit or a weakness, saying that the device invoked feelings of inferiority, or even that they'd rather not be here than consider using a mobility aid. Another common thread in the literature is the idea that using assistive tech is somehow giving up, or worse, that those who use visible aids are somehow doing it for attention or perks. Knowing when you're disabled enough can be very difficult, particularly for folks with progressive issues. Now, remember that a doctor's advice is one of the most common motivators for actually taking on assistive tech. But users regularly say that they would not want to be the ones to bring up the issue with their doctor, for fear that they'd be judged, or that the doctor would just sign on because they asked and not really because they need the tech. So they want a doctor to tell them when it's time to take on the assistive tech, but they won't tell the doctor that they're struggling without it. And it expects a certain level of expertise and possibly even psychic power that's beyond the capability of a doctor who sees them for such a short amount of time. There is a fear of being seen to be taken advantage of the system, right? Which can, of course, be traced back to many a political talking point about benefits fraud. The equitation of laziness with disability, it's baked right into our language, right? Wheelchair users are definitionally not standing on our own two feet. So users can have very complicated feelings about their conditions, that being sick and disabled makes them weak or a burden or plain just not normal. And that can really impact how people engage with tech. I was really struck by one respondent who reported not having seen her friends in over a year. She was able to drive, but she couldn't walk for long distances. And she looked into getting a blue badge. But when she learned that she'd have to call herself disabled to apply, she flat out refused to fill out the paperwork. She suffered all this isolation just because she refused to take on that label. And we can see how she got there. But disability is not a bad word. It is, in fact, the only minority group that anyone can become a part of at any moment. And we know that those who self-identify as disabled are the group that is most likely to utilize assistive tech when it's needed. They've already put in that mental work. The tech is not a threat to their identity, right? So let's take a look at the tech itself. This might be based on past experiences, and of course, there are some totally valid complaints here. Anyone who has tried to find a good place to prop up their cane only to have it clatter to the floor the second they let go can tell you that assistive tech can sometimes be awkward and annoying. And as we saw earlier, sometimes the tech that users get just flat out isn't good for them. But other times, there can be preemptive concerns that aren't necessarily grounded in reality. So I mentioned in the Skepticam talk that manual wheelchairs are highly stigmatized by older users, in part because they represent a loss of independence. Older folks worry that they'll be unable to push themselves, and in effect, it gives them a mobility aid that makes them less mobile. But what I had to cut for time is that the opposite is also true. Just as older folks shun manual chairs in favor of power chairs, so do younger folks shun power chairs. And the reason for this is less pragmatic, and it primarily has to do with representation. Most power chair literature and product pages are filled with nothing but older folks, which leaves the population of younger chair users in a similar position to myself back in the day. If this is the target demographic, then clearly I'm not it, right? This tech is not for me. There's also an issue with the input that younger folks are getting from their doctors. I read multiple interviews, independent from one another, with exclusively young women, interestingly, whose physios told them that they were too stubborn to end up in a power chair. And this made them feel like the chair represented a failure, so that when they did actually have to take on the chair, it felt like they hadn't tried hard enough, and their sense of self really suffered. And remember, these medical professionals are some of the most powerful figures when it comes to assistive tech uptake. This is not good messaging. And honestly, the medical sector needs to do better. If doctors aren't telling people that they can live a good life in a wheelchair, how can we be surprised when that stigma lingers? Could get really ranty here, but I'm not going to. We're going to go on to the penultimate theme, which is social networks. As with most things, a healthy social support network is crucial for effective use of assistive tech. Unfortunately, negative attitudes of friends, family, and caregivers can impact the likelihood that someone will use the tech that they need. Now, this is something I saw all the time in the service dog world. It was so common that we actually built it into our screening system, requiring users to have a plan for how to deal with this before even thinking about getting a dog. So friends and family would often reject the idea of a service dog for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they couldn't understand the utility, right? They might have perceived the user as coping fine without the dog, and so they don't understand the need. And this is a real common issue with folks that become gradually disabled. Taking on assistive tech can seem very out of the blue to folks who are on the outside, whereas it might have been a real long process to get there. Friends and family can also be concerned with awkward encounters with the public. Pretty common for business owners not to understand the laws surrounding service dogs, and that can lead to confrontations, which are no fun for anyone. Other aides bring their own challenges. Mobility aids often take up a lot of space, which can be a struggle for family members. A family carer might not see the utility in finding space for a motorized scooter when they're content to push their disabled family member around in the travel chair, which can fold into a much smaller space. But if you've never been able to unable to move yourself independently, you might not understand all those little moments that can make that really intolerable. Right? Imagine not being able to shift position to engage yourself in a group conversation, right? Or to get a better look at something in a shop. Right? It's all those little moments that make a huge difference to your quality of life, but it can really be hard to communicate that to even a well-meaning family member. And there's also the emotional component. Friends and family can feel like their help isn't being appreciated, or they feel like they're being abandoned because their person wants that independence. And of course, friends and family can be suspicious of assistive tech for the same reasons that users and healthcare workers are, right? They might feel they don't have the right training or that there isn't good evidence that this piece of tech can work for their person. They might have stigmatized views about disability or be concerned that the aid would be making things worse by creating a dependency. The idea of tech creating a dependence through overuse comes up in study after study, both among users and their support group, as if it was some sort of addictive drug. Also, when you're dealing with parents, you'll often see concerns about visible aids singling their children out for unwanted attention or bullying, which is absolutely valid. But I'd argue that withholding the tech is solving the wrong problem, right? In an ideal world, friends and family would be a part of the research, selection, and issuing of assistive tech from as early a point as possible to create an enthusiastic and well-informed buy-in. We don't live in an ideal world, but we can work on it. Another crucial component that impacts tech use is access to peer support. Access to other disabled folks' experiences can really help cut through some of the difficulty inherent in trying to communicate and trying to navigate this confusing landscape. Right? Having real people to give their opinions on AIDS can make a huge difference. You can look at all the comparison sheets you want, but nothing is going to compare to being able to talk to somebody who has similar needs to yours and getting their feedback and their lived experience. Right? It can also really just normalize disability. We know from a variety of studies that the more disabled people you know, the more comfortable you become in taking on the label of disability and all that comes with that. So, and those don't even have to be close friendships. Just being in the same space as someone who is visibly disabled or who you know identifies as disabled can shift perceptions about disability and can improve self-image. Even parasocial peer support can be helpful. Nobody taught me how to change the bearings on my wheelchair, but I was able to learn that because I happened to be following wheelchair users on YouTube. Events like Nadex here in the UK are a hotbed of disabled information sharing and socializing. There's obviously talks and market stalls to peruse, but there's also just the on-the-ground reality of being able to ride up to somebody and go, "Oh my God, I love your footplate. Where did you get it?" And honestly, there's just something exhilarating about being surrounded by that many disabled people. So often, we are the only disabled person in a given space. I got to give QED props for this. They do a great job with that. There's a lot of us there. At events like this, disability just becomes normal, as the social model says that it should. But, say it with me, getting to an in-person event is a privilege that not all disabled folks have. And online support can sometimes just add another layer of confusing information to cut through, right? Finding a group that is right for you can be more energy than you have access to. And for folks who aren't online for whatever reason, and of course, the reason might be that being online isn't accessible for disability reasons, it can be even harder. But when we can access it, good peer support can help buffet users against some of the issues that we've already discussed. So finally, we come to societal barriers, and there are two primary sub-themes here, social stigma and governmental policies. So remember earlier we talked about internalized ableism, and that obviously doesn't come from nowhere. It definitionally comes from society's existing prejudice against disabled folks, and we do it to each other as well as to ourselves. Just as respondents criticize other people for potentially putting it on for attention, so do they expect others to criticize them for doing the same. And this is another point where we see distinct racial differences, with respondents of color citing both the fear of this criticism as well as specific instances of it much more often than white respondents. Tech use was also associated with a loss of social status. So in one study commissioned by a British scooter manufacturer, 57% of respondents said they'd be concerned about using mobility aids for this reason specifically. And this isn't surprising. If we're taught to see disabled folks as not normal, or we associate tech use with inferiority or helplessness, it's no wonder that people report feeling self-conscious or vulnerable, or that people will think they're helpless when they think about the potential of using assistive tech in public. In an ableist society, such as the one you currently live in, you, fear of stigma is not unfounded. Disabled folks are discriminated against in housing, employment, and other societal venues, but also, just like other forms of social oppression, ableism can manifest in smaller ways. Being spoken over or ignored, even when you're the most qualified one in the room. Being assured that you'll be welcome at an event, only to find the space inaccessible, or plain just not being invited in the first place. It's not surprising that some folks would rather endure extra pain than publicly align themselves with the stigmatized community. And while we're on the topic of inaccessible spaces, let's take a look at public infrastructure. If the spaces that you routinely interact with don't have ramps, how likely are you to consider using a wheelchair? If governments aren't putting an emphasis on making spaces accessible, it's going to impact people's likelihood to use assistive tech. And governmental policies can impact tech in other ways. Remember our Norwegian study where only 14% of those who had access to tech underused it? Norway is a high-income country with a national service provision which provides aids tailored to the individual's needs free of charge. The costs of fitting and maintenance and training, they're all covered by the state. And the research team behind this study speculated that those variables accounted for at least some of the difference in underuse rates compared to studies in other countries. And while it's difficult to compare studies one-to-one for reasons already discussed, I think it's reasonable to conclude that it has at least some effect. Obviously, the economic status of a country is going to matter. Areas with widespread poverty are just not going to have the money to maintain a robust system of assistive tech distribution. But even in wealthy countries, we see governmental policies having a disproportionate impact on disabled folks. Right? We've already talked about the low employment rate and the disabled pay gap, but there is also what is colloquially known as the disability tax. Here in the UK, for example, the average disabled person has about £1,000 in extra expenses compared to the average non-disabled person every month. That covers things like the cost of aids and personal assistance, but also stuff like taxis to compensate for inaccessible transport links, specialist diets, and more stuff. Now, we have a benefit here called PIP, Personal Independence Payment, which is aimed at leveling that playing field. It's not tied to employment. You just have to be disabled. But the maximum you can get from that is just under £750 a month. So disabled folks are still behind at the end of every month. And on top of that, the Labour government is tightening eligibility for even that and in some pretty silly ways. So, for example, someone who needs assistance to be able to either wash their hair or their body below their waist no longer qualifies, while someone who, quote, needs to wash their body between their shoulders and their waist does. And if you think that's absurd, please write to your MP and tell them that. The UK is obviously not the only country whose policies impact the disability community. The US is staring down massive cuts to a wide variety of programs that disabled folks rely on. And Australia won't even let disabled people move to their country. And of course, governmental policies can have a direct impact on social stigma and public opinion. In America, researchers have noticed a distinct difference in social attitudes in what they call the post-ADA generation. So in 1990, thanks to the tireless work of disability activists and advocates, the U.S. passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, a landmark case enshrining human rights and social integration for disabled Americans into law. For 80s and 90s kids, the idea of seeing disabled folks out in public is entirely normal because they were able to be out in public. And this generation reports lower levels of social stigma against the disabled community compared with older generations, because disabled folks were just part of their normal. And this is why the phrase, you can't legislate morality, is nonsense. Older generations thought the disabled folks couldn't do anything because they never saw them do anything. But if cuts to AIDS and other services drive disabled folks back into the shadows, we could well see that trend turn around. And one of the things that we know will keep folks from participating in public life is the rejection or lack of access to assistive tech. So, where does that leave us? Once we strip all the nuance entirely away, there are two primary issues, right? The folks who want assistive tech and can't get it, and those who need assistive tech but don't want it. And the first is obviously much harder for us to solve as individuals, but let's see what we can do. Once you're done writing to your elected officials and promising never to vote for administrations that demonize the disabled, and if you're able, maybe finding a few fundraisers to donate to, there's some things that you can do to make the world a little bit less hostile to the disabled community and assistive tech. First, representation matters so much. Pay attention to disabled creators, right? There are disabled actors and comedians and athletes and freaking daredevils, right? We get everywhere. If you're on social media, you can start with hashtag disabled and proud, hashtag disabled and cute, or even babe with a mobility aid, and you will be spoiled for choice for new people to find to follow. Read books about disability history and by disabled authors, follow disability podcasts, get your eyeballs out there. Your attention is a currency. And start recommending stuff to others. If you want to go a little bit deeper, I'd recommend you find a good source of disability news. Living with Disability magazine is a good one here in the UK. They've got a 5-minute weekly briefing that can help you keep track of just the bigger stories without very much effort. If you want to dive into the historical context, the Disability Museum is a great place to start. And on that note, invite your disabled friends out, right? It's not only good for them, but their presence can help others who might be struggling. Remember that just seeing disabled folks in public can lower social stigma and reduce resistance to assistive tech use. Just make sure that the venue you go to is actually accessible, right? Don't forget about things like bathrooms and transport links. You would be amazed at how common that is. If you're an organizer, bring disabled voices in as early as possible. It is much easier to build accessibility in from the ground up than it is to try and adjust things later. Next, if someone close to you is struggling with the idea of using assistive tech, reach out to them. This is an issue that a lot of us are going to struggle with as our parents get older, right? It's important to think about why they're resisting tech use, because that's going to inform the best approach to take. What we know for sure doesn't work is force and shame. For a lot of people, they reject the idea of their own disability because it makes them feel like they're out of control. So trying to take away more of that control is not going to help. So as tempting as it is to just slam them bodily into the nearest wheelchair, do try to resist. Instead, think about what taking on that tech means to them. How does it make them feel to think of themselves as a person who uses a cane or a hearing aid or whatever it is? That will give you a starting point. Because we know that resistance isn't really about the aid, it's about what the aid means to the user. So someone might resist a cane, for example, because they think that it makes them, that needing it makes them frail. But you might be able to counter that by telling them stories about your totally real and not at all made up friend who's got a cane, and suddenly they were able to go lots of places again and do all the stuff that they used to love doing. You might find out that they're resisting one piece of tech because they don't think it suits their needs. Right? And maybe you can help them find things that might be able to help them navigate that information landscape or make sense of things with their medical team. Just make sure that you're consulting experts and not ChatGPT. You can also help them reach out to peer support and other disability-led resources, right? There's a lot of great podcasts out there. And even if there aren't any in-person peer groups, you can still point them in the direction of online groups. A really good place to start is All for Inclusion. They have events and moderated groups, as well as blogs and podcasts and so forth. And don't just think of this as outreach to your disabled friends and family. You should be out there ready to educate all your non-disabled contacts as well, correcting misconceptions and using your privilege to help reduce the source of some of those barriers. Now, that might look like speaking up and doing your part to combat stigma. It might look like asking the owner of your regular pub why they don't have a ramp. And if they tell you it's because they don't get any wheelchair users in there, maybe just stare at them really hard until they connect the dots themselves. Finally, if you're a disabled person who's listening to me right now, remember that internalized oppression takes work to undo. If you're afraid to use your assistive tech in public or to ask for accommodations, those are totally understandable fears when you live in an ableist society and you've been subjected to that level of social stigma. But if not doing those things is harming you, whether that means it's causing you extra pain or preventing you from going out and doing the things that you want to do, then you need to do what's right for yourself. Turn that skeptical eye inward and find what's holding you back. look at your self-talk. Do you say things to yourself that you would never say to another person? Would you look me in the eyes and tell me that I have given up because I use a wheelchair? Would you tell someone with chronic pain that they're being lazy for taking so many rests? Or would you support them and tell them to do what they need to keep themselves healthy? I'd like to think that most of you would be horrified at the idea of saying those things to someone else. So why do you say them to yourself? And I know it's really easy to be flippant like this, but I believe in you. Put in the work and give yourself grace. None of us can help our training, but we can rise above it. Remember to take your meds, and thank you for your time.
Cass. And Cass asked me specifically if I would host this evening because Cass knows that I'm also disabled, and then decided to round out his talk by making me very emotional right before I come back on to close the session. So thank you for that, Cass. I will take this moment to show off my shiny, pretty walking stick. Ooh. That I use that has got moons and stars on it, and try not to knock my microphone as I do. So thank you for an excellent talk, Cass. Really brilliant, as ever. We're going to take a short break now. I hope you've made the most of the break. I can certainly see that lots of questions have been flying through, which is exactly what we want to see. We've been sat in the Teams chat having a lovely conversation about disability. So hopefully we're going to have some of that conversation with yourselves as well. Please welcome back to your screens, Cass Peters. And I'm just going to jump right in and start asking some questions. So first up, a question from Igor. What is the most annoying thing that non-tech users do to or around tech users that we just need to stop doing immediately?
Stop touching our stuff. Please don't push a wheelchair unless you've asked if the person wants a push. Obviously, if you see somebody struggling up a hill, feel free to walk alongside them and say, hey, can I give you an assist? But absolutely 100% do not push a wheelchair if the person is not expecting it. You can really hurt someone. Their fingers can get caught in their spokes. That happened to me once. Just treat people's tech as if it's a part of their body, and that will really inform the best way to deal with it. And I think the other thing is that if you see somebody doing something that maybe you couldn't imagine being able to do in a wheelchair or, you know, with a guide dog or whatever, but they don't seem like they're struggling, you don't need to jump in and help them.
Yeah, it turns out people who are using wheelchairs regularly know what their limitations are within those wheelchairs. Yeah. And hopefully would feel comfortable to ask for a hand if they need a bit of a hand. But also, it can be sensitive to ask somebody if they need a hand first, because they might feel a bit insecure about asking, but be compassionate and respectful.
To be fair, I will take that as a jumping off point. If you're a new tech user, one of the things that you can really struggle with is learning to ask for help, because there is that sense of disabled people are helpless and, you know, but yeah, it does take practice, but you just need to kind of do it and grit your teeth the first couple of times. And you will find that most people are pretty friendly, you know, if you can't reach something on the top shelf or whatever. But that can be sort of tied in with that stigma that it can be really difficult to ask for
help. And exactly, those are the occasions when it might be perfectly polite to compassionately ask somebody, can I give you a hand? Are you struggling with anything? And accept the answer no if somebody says, no, I'm good, leave me to it. And I think this leads us nicely into the next question that we've got, which is also from Igor, which is about acknowledging people's mobility tech. So in general, is it better to acknowledge people's mobility tech or ignore it and treat users as if they aren't using it?
I would say, generally speaking, it just go ahead and ignore it. It's just a part of their body. You know, I know that some like parents struggle with, you know, how to teach their kids about mobility tech. And I think it all comes down to teaching your kids from day one that all bodies are different. So my body needs wheels and that's fine. And their body doesn't. And so just treating it as if it's just a part of who they are. Obviously, I think that we saw another question about how to talk to somebody in a chair, whether you should stand up, whether you should bend down. If the person is struggling to hear you, I know in a lot, sometimes in bar situations, particularly in a QED bar, it's very loud. And sometimes I will ask people to come down because they're only a foot or so away from my ear, but
makes
in
a
loud bar situation, that can make all the difference. But if there's no sort of obstruction to communication, just stand, you're fine, you know?
Yeah, and I think this is one of those things that, and I know we're going to come to another question later about compounding disabilities and how our disabilities might interact with each other. There's occasions when I'm talking to yourself, Cass, where I actually need to crouch down because my sensory processing struggles with hearing if I can't read your lips and I can't hear you directly facing me. So I might need to make an adaptation which is more about managing my own disability than it is about crouching down and potentially infantilizing you who's seated. But then in those cases, I might look for a chair that I can grab so that we can sit face to face rather than crouching for too long.
Yeah. And I think most disabled folks can sort of read body language. You know, obviously neurodivergence is a compounding factor, but most disabled folks can read body language well enough to be able to tell when somebody is treating us like we're a child. Because more often than not, that manifests in things like, you know, I will pay for the bill and the waiter will talk to my spouse. Yeah. You know, I'm the person who's handing you the credit card, but you're handing it back to someone else because I couldn't possibly have my own money. And, you know, I have been the lesser disabled person in situations where I've been out with friends who are in power chairs and I've had the situation where the waiter has talked to me and said, oh, does she need anything? And my response has always been, well, why don't you ask her? Fine. We generally can tell. Expect competence.
Yeah.
If you act as if you expect competence, that will generally be received.
Yeah. Fantastic. Speaking of commenting on people's mobility aids, I'd have a slightly different rule of thumb. Absolutely, the rule of thumb you gave around not commenting on people's aids because it's just part and parcel of who they are. I would also say if it's clear that they've made some adaptation to their aids, where they've expressed their personality somehow. I went to a conference recently and a girl had these beautiful hearing aids with this gorgeous little pattern on it that was really clearly visible and very bright and colourful. And it was clearly her way of showing her personality. So when I chatted to her, I said, oh, I really love your hearing aids. They're really cool. And we had a little bit of a back and forth. And if you've, you know, you've got little spoke decorations on your wheels, then it's perfectly appropriate to say, oh, that's really cool. Is that a Pokemon thing? Or, you know, comment on somebody's personality.
Actually, at this past year's Nadex, I got to meet the woman who runs Tubi Life. And she makes accessories for folks who use feeding tubes. And one of the things that she makes really nice backpacks to carry the apparatus, but she makes colorful patterned tape because you have to tape the feeding tube to your face. And she said her motivation behind that is that people are going to notice the tube. It's not something they're used to. It's something that they are going to see first thing. So if I make it pretty and colorful and interesting, I give them some way to break that ice and say, ooh, I love that tape. It's very colorful. And it gives them something to comment on that we can then, it's been commented on.
It's a relief. Yeah, we've broken that tension.
Yeah.
So we've got a question from Anonymous, somebody who asked, what would you say for people who are struggling? I've started reading this. I've realized it's my question. I asked this question. And what would you say for people who are struggling, but whose doctor maybe hasn't agreed that they need assistive technology? So maybe their doctor has some misconceptions about disability. I heard lots of times early on in my disabled experience that I was too young to have chronic pain and that they didn't want me to become reliant on certain things or their own, you know, personal bias. If people are struggling and their doctor hasn't told them, yes, I agree you need some support, is there a way that people can feel strong in supporting themselves?
Yes. I mean, obviously, you know, I want to put the caveat here that, again, if you use an aid that isn't for you, you can hurt yourself. So you do need to do the research and be sort of aware of what risks you're putting yourself in. But if it's like a cane or something, which is quite, you know, you're not going to give yourself a pressure sore. You know, the worst you're going to do is maybe you're going to bend your elbow a little bit weird while you're figuring out how tall the cane is going to be. It can be okay to just take that on and then go to your doctor and say, hey, I've been using a cane for the past month and it's really helped me. Can we move forward? I mean, I would love to say in an ideal world, oh, go find yourself a doctor who is an ableist. But we all know that, once again, take a shot. That is a privilege that not every person is going to be able to have access to. You can also reach out to peer support. You can find people with similar concerns and see, like, did they have an information pack that they gave to their doctor? Or do they have a professional recommendation that you can bring into your doctor and say, hey, look, this doctor says that young people can be disabled as well. All that information is out there, but it's just about finding it. And unfortunately for a lot of disabled folks, you know, energy is not always our friend. We don't always have the number of spoons that we need. But I would say dive in yourself with the caveat of make sure you're keeping yourself safe, and then try to loop your doctor back in and say, look, this is helping me. I would really like to go further with this.
We could give an entire talk about how to coaching other disabled people on how to get the best from your medical professional, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and this is the thing is as I was going through the literature, there were all of these people saying, well, if only my doctor told me I needed this. And I just think, you really are expecting a lot from doctors. Because I've, as a wheelchair user, I've experienced so many doctors whose priority has been, well, we want to get you out of that chair. And it's like, well, the chair is my independence. You know, I am not wheelchair bound, right? The wheelchair does not bind me. The wheelchair is the thing that enables me to get out of the house. You know, if you had a magic wand and you wanted to solve all my other problems that cause me to not be able to get around without the chair, then that's fine, but that's not my priority.
It's almost a perfect example. I've just been to Barcelona for a long weekend. Very lovely. Notice how my freckles are coming out. But I was very much having a conversation with somebody where I was like, well, you know, we're staying about a 40-minute walk out of the city. So if we want to do lots of walking around the city, let's just get a Metro card and we'll get the Metro into town so we can save our steps and energy for once we're already there. And that might be exactly the same thing for using a wheelchair. If I've got accessibility that I can get there without draining all my energy getting around, now I can spend that precious energy on socializing, on engaging with people, on working, on the things that I actually want to do.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, honestly, the chair was magical. The chair made so much of a difference because I wasn't using all of my energy literally just keeping my body upright, you know. And I had it to do fun things.
Well, exactly, yeah. Igor asked, at what point should one start thinking about using a technology and how to recognize the signs that you actually need it rather than just subconsciously, stubbornly refusing?
It's honestly a great question, Igor. It's a lot of introspection. It's, you know, am I making this harder for myself? You know, and when I'm walking around, do I wish I had something to lean on at all times? Am I walking around my house leaning on the walls? Am I struggling to hear conversations when I'm at the pub? You know, am I straining my eyes when I'm reading things? Am I struggling with whatever form of neurodivergence that, you know, maybe I'm not willing to admit is as serious as it is? It just comes down to, is it impacting you on a regular basis? Because that really is the difference between a disability and just, say, a impairment. Is a disability has a long-term impact. It impacts you on a regular basis. And if that's true, then you need to take a look at what you could be doing for yourself to make your life easier. Because, again, the chair was magical. You know, finding the aid that works for you can make such a huge difference. And if you're walking around spending all this extra energy, maybe ask yourself why you're resisting that.
Sometimes our thought process can actually be a key indicator of what it is that we need, especially if, and I know I commonly have the thought, and I know lots of people have said this to me, having that thought of, it shouldn't be this hard, or why does everybody else seem to find it so much easier? I just broken somehow? And sometimes the answer is, yeah, a little bit. Let's just get the support that I need to engage with things. And the reason other people find it easier is because it's easier for them. And if you're finding it hard, there might be something to help.
I think that's a lot of folks' experiences when they're coming to the realization of their own neurodivergence in adulthood. Yeah. Just that they've spent their entire lives wondering how everybody else seems to have it all together. And it turns out it's because their brains work differently.
We've had a question from Kat who says, on offering help to folk with visible disabilities, is there a good rule of thumb? Should we offer help? But if we've offered some help, how do we then not take it personally when we get told to F off?
I mean, you know, ideally we won't tell you to F off. But yeah, don't take it personal. I've heard this. There's been this thing floating around in disability circles that some people think that we should always take help because then if we don't take the help, then people won't offer it anymore. But I've been in multiple situations where someone offering me help, or more to the point, just giving me help without asking, has actually made my life more difficult because they've grabbed a door out of my hands when I'm already pushing it open and they've made me fall over and nearly fall out of my chair, for example. Or I don't know what it is with some bipedal people that they think that by holding the door that I can magically phase through their body as they stand in the doorway. I really do not understand this, but this happens all the time. I really would say just offer help if you think someone is struggling. You know, look at them, see if, you know, do they look like they know what they're doing? You know, if you see a guy in a wheelchair and he's loading his groceries into the boot of his truck, he's probably done that as many times as you have. He probably knows what he's doing. If a bag of oranges goes flying into the parking lot and, you know, you can run over and say, hey, can I give you a hand, pick him up? You know, and obviously in a dangerous situation, help first, ask later, you know. But yeah, offer help, assume competence, and be polite if somebody says, no, I've got it, thanks.
I guess it's about trusting the other person. And it's about shifting that mindset because we all have this kind of internalized bias against disability. Sometimes we make that assumption that, well, they must just be not know what they need, or that we don't respect them enough to know what they need from us. So shifting that framing of, this is just another human being who said they're fine, I'll just take them at their word. I'll trust that that's the truth, right? Because they know better than I do. They know their body better than I do.
Yeah, I think there can be this thing with non-disabled folks that they really just can't imagine what it would be like. You know, you'll have people come up to you and literally say, oh, it's so lovely that you're out today. Like, I'm on the bus. I'm just
my life.
Going to the store. It's fine. I'm not doing anything inspirational. But they'll say things like, oh, I couldn't live like that. You know, good on you, mate, but I couldn't live like that.
And that's like, the polite version of that statement, isn't it? Right.
Yeah, just that you could not possibly imagine living a good life in a disabled body. And that's really horrifying when you think of the fact that literally anyone could become disabled at any time. And when you have that mindset, that's why you get people who say things like, I would rather not be here rather than use a mobility aid. And that's, you know, when we think about assisted dying laws, we have to take that kind of mindset into account, that maybe what counts as a good life isn't necessarily what you have in mind, given that you have been raised in an ableist society.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a question from Kat who says, do you have any advice for someone who may be coming to terms with having one or more disabilities?
Yeah, be gentle on yourself. It is really hard. And obviously, like, you're coping with this complete change of identity at the same time that you're coping with your symptoms, right? So, you know, for me, when I was first really ill, I was bedbound and I was coping with the fact that I could no longer do all of the things that I wanted to be able to do. You know, I couldn't, I was working on a PhD and now I couldn't even read. And you're coping with that at the same time that you have no energy to cope with anything. So you really need to give yourself grace. And you need, I would really recommend that people immerse themselves in the disability community as much as they can, because there is so much joy there. And there's so many ways to live a good life. And even if you're looking at something and go, well, that's not necessarily for me, at least you're looking at people who are living a good life. And you can say, oh, well, cool, that's possible. You know, I might not be, you know, wanting to go rock climbing, but that would be an option if I did want it. Isn't that amazing? So, yeah, immerse yourself in the disability community and, you know, give yourself grace. You are unlearning all of that. And, you know, and you will continue to unlearn that. Like, I know that I still have internalized ableism. I haven't worked my way all the way through it. I will die before I am able to do that because we cannot help our training. But we can recognize it, I think, is the key, is when we recognize it in ourselves to kind of like put a pin in that, you know, put a post-it note in your brain or your mind palace or whatever you use and say, right, this is a thing that I need to unpick. And then when you have the time, go back and unpick it and say, okay, where did I learn that? What is the actual truth behind that? And if you keep working at it, you'll get there.
I think that's really great advice, especially those communities are just so vibrant and have definitely helped me shape how I engage with a lot of these conversations. And it's a great way of learning the beautiful variety among the disabled people that are part of our world just by engaging with those communities. I remember when I was early diagnosed, I was told by a doctor that she was very worried about all the disability forums and that it's where people go to really just become more and more negative. And it, just the opposite of the experience that I've encountered is how positive and frustrated and angry and venting about the state of things and how terrible things are, but also looking for the positives and having this really vibrant and exciting community.
I think, and I think that's the thing, is there's a difference between everybody being negative or everybody being justifiably angry. You know, like, I am very angry at the Labour government right now because of the PIP cuts, because this is the example that I gave is one of many. It's freaking nonsense. And the argument that they're making is that by taking away personal independence payment, they're encouraging disabled people to get into work. That, you know, I think the thing, you know, the Tories always tried to use the idea that there was benefits fraud, this rampant benefits fraud. And I think now there's been so many studies that you just can't use that anymore.
Benefit fraud just doesn't exist. It's one of the few frauds that doesn't exist, right?
And honestly, PIP is responsible of the tiny, tiny amount of benefits fraud. PIP is responsible for like 0.004% of it. Like it's a rounding error. It's insanely small. So I think they got to the point where they could no longer use that argument. So now they're falling back on the old trope of the lazy disabled folks who are staying at home because they could be working. But PIP is not tied to work. You can be working full time and have a full be an enhanced daily living, enhanced mobility on PIP.
That's because being disabled is really, really expensive, right?
It is incredibly expensive. And if you take away somebody's PIP, if they, for example, don't have an accessible bus route to where they work and you take away their PIP, how are they going to pay for those taxis that they've been using to get to work with? You know, or how are they going to pay for their personal aide who comes and helps them get ready in the morning or whatever it is that they spend that money on? You are going to get people leaving work because of the PIP cuts. And also, if you're going to say, oh, well, we need to push these disabled people into work because they're lazy, et cetera, what are they doing to ensure that ableism in the workplace goes down? You know, what are they doing to ensure that that doesn't become a factor in hiring or that accommodations are actually being met? You know, the number of people that I've spoken to who have been hired for a job and then waited months for the accommodation and have ended up having to leave the job because the accommodation's not been forthcoming, nothing's being said by the Labour government about fixing things like that. And that's not being negative. That's being filled with righteous rage.
And it's actually a question I had later down in our Q&A that we have this idea that discrimination against disabled people is illegal and therefore it either doesn't happen or if it does happen, you just report it. Or that, you know, having accessible workspaces is a legal requirement and so it just happens. And I think there's this risk that we trust the legal system and don't realise that it doesn't work that way, that just because something's illegal doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and just because something's a legal requirement doesn't mean that it does.
Tax fraud is illegal. I know which problem you could solve that would bring in more money. But yeah, it is a real problem. And the vast majority of accommodations to workplaces don't cost very much money. I don't know the British figures, but in the US, the average accommodation in a workplace costs less than $200. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it can be zero. It can be things like, I need somebody to put a chair next to the copier machine so that when I have to sit there and, you know, when I have to do a bunch of copies, I can sit down. That doesn't cost anything. Yeah. But when you have to fight your employer for that.
And we talked in the break.
It's not a landscape.
We talked in the break a lot about this idea that disabled people are having to fight every step of the way, right? It's not just fighting with your doctor to get the diagnosis and the treatment and the support that you need, but it's also fighting with your employer to get the reasonable adjustments you need. And it's fighting with your housing provider to get the stuff that you need at home to move around, and fighting to get how many people get their benefit claims refused the first time round and then have to go through and...
A huge number. Have to go to a tribunal, and most of the 90% of the tribunals are successful, which implies that they're just turning people down, you know, who are obviously qualified. It's one of the reasons that I included a couple of pictures from the Capitol crawl and some of the other disability rights movement. And it's, again, unfortunately, a lot of my disability history is very America-centric. Mm-hmm. I don't know as much about British disability history, but I think that when we think about the civil rights movement, the disability rights movement really kind of gets forgotten. Like in the U.S., the disability rights movement, the longest sit-in at a government facility is still the 504 protests in California. And like the Capitol crawl is one of the most beautiful pieces of protest art I've ever seen, where you have disabled people literally crawling up the steps of the U.S. Capitol, dragging their mobility aids behind them, demanding that the ADA be signed. You've got people at ADAPT chaining their wheelchairs to inaccessible buses and forcing police officers with inaccessible vehicles and inaccessible jails to figure out what they're going to do with these people. And there's a long history of radical social action by the disabled community. And I feel like it needs more attention when we think about civil rights.
Absolutely. We've got a question from Karen. How is the NHS doing? Is it improving because of campaigning groups and people like yourself, or is it failing because there's no money to do all that they know needs doing? If you could just answer that quickly.
It's
a big question.
Unfortunately, the NHS has been gutted and is being sold for parts. It's really a shame. The NHS is not doing what it needs to do. And part of that is the money, and part of that is really old and kind of out of date bureaucracy. Like some of the access to wheelchair service, for example, is really difficult for folks who don't have an obvious, like I mentioned, spinal cord injuries. They have a direct route, but folks with ME, folks with POTS, folks with Ehlers-Danlos, they're going to struggle to get access to a wheelchair, and then they're going to have to buy one off, you know, eBay or whatever, what have you, and hope for the best, hope it fits, and hope they don't hurt themselves with it. It really needs the NHS needs more disabled people in positions of power to be able to acknowledge that these problems are systemic, and, you know, in an ideal world, when the NHS was properly funded, those issues would still need to be solved.
Igor asked a related question. Do you know an example, knowing that your expertise is in UK and US systems, maybe not, do you know an example of a healthcare system that's doing okay in this regard?
Denmark is always held up as the place with healthcare and social care. Denmark is really good about integrating people with pretty severe disabilities into public life. So they're always sort of held up as, you know, the goal to meet.
Nice. We've got a question about ChatGPT. So Paul asked, you've suggested avoiding ChatGPT, but for someone who has difficulty expressing themselves coherently, it could also be a useful assistive tech. At what point would we draw the line? And again, I think there's a whole talk in this, but...
Assisted communication is not my area of expertise, but I would worry about leaning on AI models as they actually exist. Now, it's my understanding that there are more intelligent AI models coming down the pipeline, but I think that's a different talk. I would say you would have to talk to somebody who is more, who has more area of expertise in assisted communication. I would maybe start with a speech therapy department. I would talk to a GP about that, or potentially get into the disabled community and see if there's people out there who know. I'm more familiar with things like talk boards. There's a lot of people who use iPads. But obviously, if it's a question of making your thoughts coherent, maybe there are other things that can help, but that's not my area of expertise.
I'm a fan of Goblin Tools, which is often used by neurodivergent people, because you can write an email in there and ask it to make it sound a bit smarter or make it appropriate for different kind of audiences. So you're still using your own words, but it's just kind of shifting it slightly. And it also has a tool for interpreting the tone of an email. So say you receive an email and you want to know, ooh, is this person being snarky with me? And it kind of attempts to reassure you whether they are or aren't.
That is really excellent. I would say hardline, avoid using ChatGPT for research. Yeah. You know, because it doesn't know anything. It's just an auto, you know.
It's an auto.
It's a large language model. It makes things up. But as far as using it for a communication tool, there might be potential there, but not my area.
And it has to be part of the conversation going forwards with AI, because it does have that potential. Yeah. But let's use it responsibly.
Yeah. Hopefully there will be more intelligent AI models coming down the pipeline, and, you know, that won't cause us any other problems.
We have a question from Anonymous. Both your talk and the questions indicate that non-disabled people struggle to just be chill around us disabled people. Any advice?
Particularly, I think, you know, for someone who has sort of a standard body plan and is just in a chair, people still struggle. But I think, you know, when you start dealing with like limb differences and facial differences or speech impediments and that sort of stuff, people really tend to kind of freak out. I guess the question is it advice for the disabled people or advice for the non-disabled people? The advice for the non-disabled people is please just be chill. Yeah. We are really just humans.
One other thing I think helps with that is just follow a load of disabled people on social media and just get used to seeing that and seeing those talking points, right?
Yeah, it's all tied into the representation of just, you know, these are just normal people. If you're struggling with the visuals, you can start with podcasts and sort of move in. But I think the more normalized it becomes, the more chill people become. And then, you know, this ties back into, please invite your visibly disabled friends out with you. Please bring people out in public, because just having people out in public encourages people to think that we are normal and able to be out in public and able to be capable human beings.
And it's something you're fantastic at, Cass, is being not only visibly disabled and there in our public spaces, but also talking very openly about it. It shouldn't be on you as a disabled person to do that, but that you do that is definitely helping people in your community, and you do such a brilliant job of it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just think it's, disability is just a part of human diversity, and we just need to treat it that way. It's not a bad word. It's not inherently problematic. Like, there are some things about people's disabilities that they might not enjoy. Like, yeah, chronic pain sucks. I don't particularly enjoy migraines, but that doesn't mean that I'm ashamed of being disabled. Like, it's just a part of who I am, and that's not going to change. So why should I hide it?
Absolutely. Kat has asked a related question about people hiding their disabilities. So she asked, do people hide disability for fear that the cause will be misunderstood? For example, fat people might worry that their symptoms are seen as due to fatness or laziness rather than disability.
This is so common. Every person, like, it's at this point, it's a joke within the disabled community, and I'm sure it's a joke within the fat movement or the body positivity movement of just you go to the doctor and, oh, I've got a broken leg. Well, have you tried losing weight? Yeah, super, super common. It's also common when you're trans. Yeah. You know, oh, you're having these problems. Have you tried going off your HRT?
No, because that's life-saving medication.
Those are my meds. I need those. It is a real problem. And I think, you know, this is the problem with expecting that level of expertise about disability from the medical profession, because they are part of our society. They are fat phobic and queer phobic and racist and ableist, just like everybody else. You know, we've seen, obviously, we've seen doctors who are anti-vax. Like they can fall into those fallacies just like anybody
else. We see ableism cropping up in fat stigma, right? That oh well, you know, I'm just worried about your health. The only reason I'm commenting on your weight is because I'm worried about your health, as if being unhealthy or having a health issue is a bad thing, right? I'm not healthy.
And as if you couldn't infer anything about someone's health by what they look like on the outside.
Absolutely. Kat also asked, is there research on how often people feel that they are representing disabled folk, and so they might mask emotions that they don't want to be seen as the grumpy cane user, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a real common thing. Let's see if I can find the... wonder if he's still active. Yeah, William Peace. Oh, he's... Well, his last post was 2019, okay. So I'm not sure if he's still active. But he used to keep a blog called Bad Cripple. And he was very much just... He wrote a couple of books. I think one of them was called Bad Cripple. Absolutely owned that. He's like, I am just going to take on all of the angry cripple stereotypes. I am the bad cripple, and I will take that on behalf of all of you that have to mask, and I will be the angry one yelling about our rights. Yeah, super, super common. People moderate their tone all the time because, oh, well, I don't want to be seen as that angry cripple. I don't want to be, because that is such a common stereotype that we've been made bitter by the fact that, oh, you're just angry that your legs don't work. Like, no, I'm angry because you don't have a ramp.
And anyone would be, right? Like, of course we're going to be bitter that the world is not designed to be accessible for us and makes our lives harder every step of the way. Like, the fact that most of us are not bitter 100% of the time is... Say something. Imagine how positive we would be if the world was better. Like, we'd be the happiest people on the planet.
Yeah. And I mean, we it's one of the things that you see spoken up a lot about in the disabled community is avoiding toxic positivity. Like, it's not something, you know, we don't have to always be excited and happy about everything. That is not a thing. That can be a very toxic trait as well. It is okay to be angry about a thing that you are justifiably angry about.
Well, from one toxic trait to another, Igor has asked, how could you theoretically force a toxically masculine relative to actually use their goddamn assistance tech asking for a friend?
Yeah, I mean, I wish we could force them. There are some people that I was having a conversation with a friend of mine. He is 72 years old. He's had two major falls that, like, falls on the ground, broken bones, weeks in hospital recovery afterwards. And when I told him, oh, you know, have you thought about using a cane? And he said, oh, no, that's for old people. Dude, you are 72 and you have had two major
you're
falls.
You're now officially an old person. Just use the damn stick.
I wish that was honestly that I think that may have been the impetus for the Skepticamp talk was I ended up going on a deep dive because of that conversation. I really wish you could force them, but you just can't. Force doesn't work. Shame doesn't work. You really need to find a thing that they want to be able to do and can't, I think is ultimately the thing that's worked best for me is, oh, don't you wish, you know, with my mother-in-law, you know, don't you wish you could go out and do these things and hang out with the grandchildren? Don't you wish you could do, you know? If you approach it as a positive thing, you might have better luck. And I mean, with some people, you might be able to talk to them about, you know, this is where the roots of ableism are, but I think that might be a little bit deep of a conversation if you're already mm-hmm. struggling. You know, try and find a story that works for them and just push it. And ultimately, just grit your teeth and hope for the best.
And sometimes half of it is figuring out what their unspoken fear is, because, you know, they're saying to you, oh, that's for old people. But that might not be the thing that they're scared of. The thing that they're scared of is something that they wouldn't admit. And that's just the, yeah. that's the excuse.
You know, they might be afraid, like some people feel that it makes them a target, especially older women will say, oh, you know, I don't want to use a cane because that means muggers yeah. are going to target me. And it's like, well, that's a possibility. Or you could really hurt yourself falling over.
So you've got a great weapon if a mugger targets you. So
exactly. There you go.
Andrew asked, you mentioned racial disparities in a number of the statistics you quoted. Why do you think that these occur?
Some of it is down to sort of cultural differences in how people. I think I talked about this in the Skepticam talk that Hispanic participants tended to use personal aids. And so when they looked at people who were using assistive tech, they tended to think of them as, oh, those are lonely people. Those are people who don't have people in their life. So that's what tech mm-hmm. meant to them. But I think for a lot of particularly Black, again, very America-centric, so I don't really know the statistics for a lot of stuff on the British side. But the level of medical racism is so strong. There are still there are myths about Black bodies having higher pain tolerances. There are myths about Black heart rates being different. So you might have somebody whose heart rate is elevated, but that's not being recognized because on the chart it says, oh, well, for a white heart rate, it's this, and for a Black heart rate, it's this. You have Black folks who are growing up in this culture where they're being mistreated by doctors, where you have the legacy of like the Tuskegee experiments, where Black men were deprived of treatment and died horrible, painful deaths when they didn't need to because white doctors thought they were getting good data out of it. And you get a mistrust of the medical profession because of that. And so when a doctor says, oh, you're going to need this, or you're going to need this, there's going to be a suspicion of, oh, well, are you just giving me that so I'll go away? Or, oh, you're going to give me a walker, but I know it's going to be used and it's going to fall apart and I'm going to have to patch it together with duct tape. So I'm not going to use it because I'm afraid it's going to break mm-hmm. on me. And so you get this just distrust of the medical profession. And then that sort of becomes another factor in whether or not they're going to take up the tech.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a question from Anonymous who said, if you have an invisible disability, how do you deal with the dirty looks and rude questions?
Yeah, I feel you. I used to be invisibly disabled and when I was using a service dog. So that was an interesting experience of why do you don't yeah. look disabled. Well, yeah. What does disabled look like, really? Yeah, you know, it really, it depends on, you know, what your mental fortitude is. You can, you know, if you're willing to have that conversation and you think that you can educate people, there's an opportunity for education there. You know, the question, what does disability look like? And you can pop off with a bunch of different disabilities that are invisible. So someone might have a hypermobility disorder. They're not going to look disabled. You know, somebody might be deaf. That doesn't look like anything. Somebody might have a seizure disorder. That doesn't look like anything. And so if you have a couple of those and you kind of keep them in your back pocket, and when somebody says, well, you don't look disabled, and you can say, well, actually, there's lots of people who have disabilities and don't look disabled. You know, epileptic folks don't look disabled, but they very much are. And that can be, I found that to be a really useful sort of comeback. But you will just get people who are assholes yeah. and you just have to remind yourself that it's not you, that it is very much that.
And the society that we live in. And that yes. can be an extra barrier against using that assistive technology, right? I know there's times when I am making the choice between, do I use my stick today or do I have the energy to push through and not have the mental energy to deal with people asking, oh, what have you done? How have you hurt yourself? What's the injury? It's like, No, I'm just still disabled, always disabled. Just need a bit of extra help today.
People that have only ever seen me at my house, like, you know, the package delivery people or the guy who washes the windows or whatever, they'll see me out in public and they go, oh my God, what happened? What do you mean? The chair. No. There is an interesting blip in the data with tech use because there's some people who are invisibly disabled who report, you know, some days I just can't deal with the public. I can't deal with the questions. So I just bring a cane, even though I don't need it, because it makes me look disabled. And then people don't yell at me for using the disabled bathrooms.
Yeah, that's the other choice you have to make sometimes is that, you know, I'd like the almost privilege of looking disabled right now. But you also have the privilege of not looking disabled sometimes as well.
Yeah, I think the sunflower lanyard has been really good for that. I think most people recognize that as a sign of invisible disabilities. But again, you're going to get the people who are just like, oh, you're faking it. Or kids these days, you're too weak. You're too soft.
Yeah.
And you just have to remember that that's their problem. It's not you.
Well, we've taken some steps backwards when it comes to some of these conditions, right? Especially with that, you know, kids these days, it's a fashionable diagnosis sort of idea. It makes it harder in the short term, but we'll progress through that just like we've progressed through it every other time. Eventually.
Yeah. I mean, the current Health and Human Services Secretary comes to mind when we think about some of the things we're going backwards on.
Kat asked, has there been much research on how stigma from various disabilities compound each other? For example, if an ADHD kid has been called lazy quite a lot, they might be more likely to resist help.
I don't know that there's been research done on that, but it's a fascinating topic. I would absolutely believe that that happens. And I think you get similar things like folks with autism might not have the processing and the words to be able to talk to their doctor and communicate what their actual needs are. I don't know that there's been research, but I would absolutely believe that that is a compounding issue. And you know, anybody with multiple disabilities will tell you that they can sort of ricochet off each other, that this is, you know, one disability is going to cause you problems that's going to make another one of your disabilities worse. And that's just sort of a thing that we all need to learn how to juggle.
People forget, right, that people with disabilities often have multiple disabilities. It's far more common to have multiple disabilities than to just have a single disability. So sometimes you're having to make calls based on what you need, based on what's not going to flare up your other conditions or have a negative impact on other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, you know, I'm going to need to take the tube today, even though I've got the chair, because I know that I'm going to need the energy, because otherwise I'm going to end up with a migraine the next day.
Yeah. We've got two more questions, and then we're going to let you have a break and go and join the pub if you would like to. The first is, are there any central resources on accessibility? If I'm scouting a venue, who do I tell about good or bad accessibility other than the owner and guests? Could I tell Google Maps? Are there any other ways that we can indicate these?
So I just put a link in the meeting chat. If Igor, if you could chuck that in the Twitch chat, or somebody can chuck that in the Twitch chat. There's a site called Ewan's Guide that has basically like user submitted reviews of routes and access at businesses and so forth. There's a company called the Sensory Trust, which does put that in the chat, and that's for folks with neurodivergence. So planning out routes and figuring out what sensory issues are going to be involved in. I know there's others. I can't think of them off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Access-able is another one that a lot of universities are on there.
Let me see if I can find
that. Just pop that in the chat as well for one of the mods to pop into Twitch.
Yes, that is another great one. And Google Maps actually is really responsive to, you know, if they've told you that a route is wheelchair friendly and you find that it's not, I've had really good luck reporting that to them. Their stuff tends to be pretty good. When it comes to When it comes to the tube, they can be a little bit iffy, so I would make sure you check the step-free tube map rather than Google Maps, but because there's different levels of step-free, and Google Maps doesn't seem to acknowledge that in a lot of cases. So I'll go to a place and go, oh, Google told me this is step-free, and find out, oh, no, it's step-free between the train and the platform, but not between the platform and the street, which is no
bad. And that's half the battle sometimes, right, isn't it, is that it's one thing. If you're a non-disabled person, you want to help out a disabled friend, call a venue before you go and ask about their accessibility, but also learn the follow-up questions, because a lot of venues will tell you, yeah, it's fully wheelchair accessible because there's no steps inside, but it doesn't have an accessible bathroom and there's a step to get in. So it's yeah. not truly accessible. Yeah. So having those follow-up questions ready can be useful.
And that's another good point is there is no such thing as 100% accessible. Something that is accessible for one person might not be accessible for somebody else. So a blind user that I follow has recently just gotten a new stove, which is it's all app controlled and stuff, which is great for somebody who maybe doesn't have the best finger dexterity because they can do it all by voice. But because it doesn't have buttons, it is no longer, it's just a yep. box that she now owns. She can't use it because it's all yep. touchscreen. So yeah, things that are accessible for one person are not necessarily accessible for somebody else. And that's why it's so important to bring disabled people in as early as possible and to get a variety of disabled folks or a disabled person that is, you know, a specialist yep. in this, that, you know, they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and absolutely that can be a key thing because it's not all disabled people know anything about this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Pay for the consultants to come in and give you the advice. If you work for an organization, actually get the experts, ideally if they've got lived experience as well. But the key thing is trust that some of this is expert stuff that we need to understand. So our final question, I think people have been admiring your beautiful backdrop because the question is where did you yes. get the rabbit mask from?
Oh, the rabbit mask that's one of my pieces.
Oh, wow.
So I've got the rabbit and the cat and the skull. Yeah, this is what artistic chaos looks like.
Amazing. Cass, thank you so much for talking with us tonight. I've had a really lovely conversation. I hope people have enjoyed the Q&A session. Will you be joining the Zoom pub?
Oh,
fantastic.
Absolutely.
So I'm always sure there. If our attendees would like to meet your pets and say hello to you, you'll be in there.
I will go let them in.
In the meantime, we'll be back next month. See you next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow @SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.